From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the co-creator of Murder, She Wrote and Columbo. William Link also co-wrote many made-for-TV movies about social issues, ranging from school integration to terrorism. Jan Morris has traveled around the world and written many books about her journeys. Coming up, we talk about her more personal journey from man to woman after a sex change operation. And we have reviews of Neil Young's new album and of the new movie, The Fabulous Baker Boys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. In Chicago, it's the final day of elections for representatives who will exert local control over the city's public schools. The voting is mandated under a new school reform law. NPR's Cheryl Duvall has details.
The counting of ballots tonight will mark the beginning of a new era in the operation of the Chicago Public Schools. Local school councils, consisting of parents, community residents, teachers, and principals, will assume powers formerly held by the central administration, including curriculum development, the hiring and firing of staff, and managing each school's budget. Council members are elected to 2-year terms. All voting-age residents in the area near each school are eligible to cast ballots, and yesterday, 133,000 elected local school councils in Chicago's elementary schools. Election monitors expect a large voter turnout this evening for council elections at the city's 71 public high schools. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Federal safety inspectors said today they've found a pre-flight crack in the engine disc from a crashed DC-10 airplane. The disc was found in an Iowa cornfield almost 3 months after the crash of a United jet at Sioux City. Most of the 296 people on board that jet survived the crash. A spokesman for the investigators said that there's been no determination whether the crack led to engine failure on the plane. Investigators also say they have not determined whether the crack was detectable before the accidents. With a handshake and a hug, leaders of the United Mine Workers Union and the AFL-CIO ended 4 decades of separation today. The 150,000-member UMW rejoined the labor group during a brief reunion ceremony. The move to rejoin was initiated by the miners' union earlier this month, but UMW President Richard Trumka said it had been anticipated for some time. Colombia's most wanted man, Pablo Escobar, head of the billion-dollar Medellin cocaine cartel, has made a new appeal for a truce in Colombia's drug war. The Bogota daily La Prensa published a letter reportedly signed by Escobar, appealing for peace talks with the government. Simon Fisher reports from Bogota.
If the letter is genuine, it is the first public communique from cocaine kingpin Pablo Escobar for a long time. Colombia launched its crackdown on the drug traffickers almost 2 months ago. Escobar called for peace talks, which the government has so far consistently rejected. He said that peace in Colombia is more important than what the governments of other countries might think, presumably referring to the United States. But last weekend, the Daily La Prensa also published revelations that the government has held secret, indirect contacts with the drug cartels over a period of more than a year. These talks were apparently broken off after the assassination of Senator Luis Carlos Galan, which triggered the current clampdown. The letter was sent by fax to several Colombian newspapers and carried a fingerprint for identification. However, it has not been confirmed whether the print is indeed Escobar's. For National Public Radio, I'm Simon Fisher in Bogota.
This is National Public Radio News in Washington. Police in Portugal say hundreds of American and British soldiers fought in Lisbon last night, smashing windows and cars. Police officials say they have detained 200 sailors. U.S. and British officials say all those detained have been released and no criminal charges were filed. U.S. military officials are charging that police had indiscriminately detained and beaten the sailors after a riot. A spokesman for the Pentagon said today that 102 Americans from 3 U.S. warships had been slightly hurt, and another 40 sailors and Marines were admitted to ship sick bays for treatment of injuries. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar is proposing to send a 600-member peacekeeping force to patrol border areas in Central America. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The UN peacekeeping force is meant to act as a deterrent to cross-border conflict in Central America by preventing rebels from using neighboring territory as a safe haven. The force will include 260 unarmed military observers from Canada, West Germany, Spain, and perhaps Venezuela or Colombia. They will be aided by another 340 technicians, such as pilots and medical personnel. Pérez Cuellar hopes to convince the Security Council to adopt his plan, which would enforce promises made more than 2 years ago under the terms of the Central America Peace Plan. The Bush administration has not said whether it will support the peacekeeping effort. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A Pentagon report released today says Soviet military aid to Nicaragua was down by half in the first 9 months of the year, but deliveries from Eastern Bloc allies appears to be more than making up for declining Soviet shipments. The Pentagon concludes that Nicaragua receives military assistance far in excess of its defense needs. The report says Nicaraguan government has gotten more than 152 metric tons of military gear worth an estimated $3 billion since Moscow and its allies began helping the Sandinistas. Israeli soldiers killed three Palestinians in the occupied territories today. 18 others were wounded. Much of today's violence occurred in Nablus, a West Bank town that's been a major center of rebellion. This is NPR. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
On the next Columbo.
Your wife have any enemies?
The Nord ever offended a soul. She was an extraordinary woman.
An unfaithful wife pays the ultimate price.
Columbo is one of 14 TV series co-created by my guest William Link. Some of the others are Murder, She Wrote, Mannix, and Ellery Queen. Link is now the supervising executive producer of the ABC Saturday Mystery Movie, which showcases Columbo once a month. Throughout his TV career, Link has alternated between writing mysteries and made-for-TV movies about social issues. The Execution of Private Slovic was the story of an army deserter. That Certain Summer starred Hal Holbrook as a divorced man who comes out as a homosexual. And Terrorism on Trial was about an Arab terrorist extradited to the U.S., where he is defended by a Jewish lawyer. William Link worked with his partner Richard Levinson until Levinson's death in 1987. Their work together won many awards, including Emmys, the Peabody, and NAACP Image Award, and most recently, the Ellery Queen Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Art of the Mystery. One of their most popular shows is Murder, She Wrote. I asked Link about the original concept.
Well, it was, in a sense, influenced by Dame Agatha Christie, her mysteries. And we wanted to have a woman detective, which was rare on American television. We thought the time was right, and we never thought it would be the hit that it turned out to be.
Did you have Angela Lansbury in mind for the part?
No, we had originally Jean Stapleton. She was interested, and then she didn't like the pilot script. And then CBS, Harvey Shepard, who was the head of programming then, suggested that Angela Lansbury was free and wanted to do television. So we met with her, and luckily she committed within a weekend.
Did the network have any problems about building a series around an older woman? Because frequently on detective series, the detective or the cop gets involved in some kind of passionate romance every other week. And that's something that probably wouldn't be happening with Angela Lansbury.
There were no problems in that area at all. I think we had our problems, my late partner and I, and Peter Fisher, who now executive produces the show. We didn't think it had a chance because we followed the 60 Minutes, and for 5 years they could never get a successful show in that slot. And here we come with a middle-aged woman. She doesn't have a family. No one bails her out at the end. She solves everything. Prior to that, it was usually the men who were around, you know, the female detective and would really back her up. We didn't have that. She did everything.
Since she's actually a writer in the series, it's not like she has a beat. She's not a cop. She's not a detective.
Yeah, we call that a franchise.
Okay. So how do you get her involved every week in a
probably
mystery?
Rather badly, but no one cares. I mean, she has...
she has a lot of relatives,
millions
right?
of relatives, yeah. Cousins and uncles and high school chums. The audience doesn't seem to mind. I mean, it puzzles me. But I think they're so intoxicated with Angela and just the format of the show and the way it's executed that they don't seem to mind.
There's lots of guest stars on Murder, She Wrote each week. Did you conceive of it that way initially, and if so,
well,
why?
Well, our training ground, our launching area for Murder, She Wrote was really the Ellery Queen series that we did 8 or 9 years ago. That was also Dick Levinson and Peter Fisher. And we learned there that people were interested in old movie stars who they hadn't seen in a long time. And we also learned not to do mysteries that were too intricate, too difficult. Like at times on Murder, She Wrote, we have easy murderers because then the audience can guess them and they pat themselves on the back and they return to watch it the following Sunday.
Tell us how you created the character of Columbo.
Columbo was originally born in 1960 in Hollywood and one of the brand new color shows on NBC called the Chevrolet Mystery Show was a summer replacement for Dinah Shore. And we wrote an hour suspense drama in which we introduced a cigar-chomping, rain-coated detective. It was originally played by Bert Fried on that show. It was a one-shot, and it was successful. Then we got the idea of doing it as a stage play, and then Dick and I were astonished because the character of Columbo in the play was really a secondary character, but he always got the greatest applause at the end, and people seemed to pick up on him. It was then that Universal approached us to doing it as a two-hour movie for television. That was in the very, very early halcyon days of the movie for television, actually the very beginning. It was extremely successful. It was one of the top shows of the week, and then NBC said, well, let's do this as an hour show with Peter Falk. Luckily for us, Peter did not want to do an hour show. 22 one-hour segments, he found much too constricting. And also, we could never do Columbo as an hour show. It's impossible, because you need a whole half an hour to set up the perfect crime that the brilliant murderer indulges in. But that's really the history of Columbo.
Now, the actors you originally used were considerably older than Peter Falk was when
yes.
he was cast as Columbo.
Yes. Dick and I... proving how crazy we were, our first choice was Bing Crosby. And we contacted his agent and contacted Bing, but he wanted to play golf. He did not want to return. I mean, he was in his mansion in Hillsborough outside of San Francisco. And Peter Falk we had known socially for many years in New York when he was a struggling young actor. He didn't struggle that long. And he did his first movie in which he was nominated for an Academy Award. And... he somehow got hold of a script, as actors do in Hollywood, called us and said, I will kill to play this cop. And we said, well, you know, he's a little young, but he's got that rough-hewn, that New Yorkish, that very down-to-earth demeanor, and he did it.
Was that mumbly quality something you wrote into the script or something he just brought with him?
No, Peter brought that quality. Everything else was in the stage play. The raincoat, the cigar, you see the murderer do the dirty deed, enter the cop who appears to be somewhat of a schlub. Actually, you know, that outward shoddy facade hides this brilliant computer brain. All that was in the stage play. Peter brought the humanity to it, and a lot of the humor.
Well, I want to talk with you about some of the made-for-TV movies that you've written, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is William Link. He's the co-creator of many TV shows and has co-written many made-for-TV movies. His TV shows include Mannix, Columbo, and Murder, She Wrote. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Talking about television with William Link. Let's talk about some of the made-for-TV movies that you've written. You were talking about Columbo, which was one of the early TV movies. Do you remember when you first found out that there were going to be movies made for TV and what your reaction was?
Yes, we were under contract at Universal. This is in the late 60s. We were quite excited because up to that point we were freelance writers and we had been writing the one-hour segments. And 2 hours, you really have a chance to stretch out as a writer. You can build character better. You just have a lot more time.
Well, what you and your late partner Richard Levinson started specializing in was the social drama, the issue-oriented made-for-TV movie, and some of the ones you did were My Sweet Charlie, which was about racism.
That was the first one that we did, yeah.
And
the first time that we produced, we got thrown into the deep end of the pool. We were sent to Galveston, Texas, and it was a racial movie which didn't sit too well with the denizens of the Gulf Coast. And it really was our baptism of fire. It was very, very successful. And probably My Sweet Charlie is considered the first television movie that proved you didn't have to do all car chases and Private Eyes.
Well, what was the hardest part of that movie to talk the network into? What did they object to anything?
Yes, they objected to that you had a young white woman and an older black man together alone in a bungalow on the Gulf Coast. They were very leery of even of us hinting at any romantic entanglement. Those were the 60s. Networks do not have that problem anymore.
Now, you did one of the first docudramas, The Execution of Private Slovak.
Yes.
Which was...
That was our favorite movie. And
was it?
Yeah.
Tell briefly the storyline.
Eddie Slovak was the first American GI since the Civil War who was executed for desertion. And the story really explores his character and the military justice, or lack of same, in the armed forces during the Second World War.
Now, since this was based on a real story...
Oh, yes.
Were there legal complications that you had to deal with?
No. We bought the book by William Bradford Huey, The Execution of Private Slovak. We owned that because we bought the rights from Frank Sinatra. Sinatra wanted to film it as a motion picture years before, but he got into a lot of trouble because it was about an army deserter, and the Hearst Press really took after him, Hedda Hopper, etc. He wanted Steve McQueen, who was a very young actor, to play Slovak. And then he made a mistake in those days of hiring a blacklisted writer, Albert Maltz, to write the screenplay. And that was the end. And he capitulated and took ads in the New York Times and various other newspapers saying that the American public had spoken. Actually, the Hearst Press had spoken. And he decided not to do the picture. Every year, Dick Levinson and I called his attorney in Hollywood saying, can we buy the rights from Mr. Sinatra? And finally, one year we called and we found out, much to our chagrin, that he had sold the rights to a New York commercial filmmaker. And we made a deal with him, acquired the rights, and made the picture with Martin Sheen.
I remember the story from your book, Stay Tuned, that your big fear was that at the end of The Execution of Private Slovak, after the execution, that the credits would be rolling and Ed McMahon's voice would come on,
yes,
promoting the Johnny Carson show.
And yes,
the whole spell would be broken.
Well, we called the president of NBC, and he pulled some strings, and Ed McMahon was silent that evening. Except what happened was is that, as some of the engineers are sometimes prone to do, since we had no music score per se, no dramatic score in the picture, they turned up the wind at the end. We just had a low, raw wind in the background as they carried out the coffin. It became a full-fledged gale, a hurricane, but there was nothing we could do.
Talking about television with William Link, who has written and produced many series as well as made-for-TV movies. You know, now everybody kids about the message movie of the week, the disease of the week movie. Do you
right.
think that the social issue movie has become much too formulaic recently?
Yes. When we started them, there were maybe a handful a year. Now it's a full-fledged cottage industry, and it's true. It gets to be a bit much, especially the very exploitable and exploited true crime dramas. I'm personally very tired of them, and I just wish, you know, they would have more varied fare. Maybe cable will help out.
I have a friend who's writing a made-for-TV movie now that's under consideration and so on, and he's learning how to write acts to fit around the commercials, and I think there's seven acts, if you count.
In a two-hour, there's seven acts, yes.
Yeah, so this is the kind of thing you have to take into account whenever you write a made-for-TV movie?
I never do.
You don't?
No, you sit down, you write the best story, you build it correctly, you construct it correctly, you pay it off correctly, as well as you can, and then you can always find a place, I have found, where you can fit the commercials. You cannot allow, you know, that problem to interfere with the telling of the story. I don't believe.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about casting. Have you ever had problems with getting someone who you really think is wrong for the role, but who an executive wants to put in because it'll be good for tune-in?
It's always a fight with the two-hour movies. The networks have very, very, I think, bizarre choices about who brings people in. Luckily, I cannot think of being forced to use an actor or actress in a role for one of our television movies that we really didn't want. Problem is sometimes, you know, they'll want, like, oh, get us Dustin Hoffman. Well, Dustin Hoffman is not going to do a movie of the week. So sometimes what you do is you come back and you tell them, you know, we talked to the agent and he's not available. Sometimes we even do nefarious things like never calling an agent and telling the network the person is not available.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a trade secret, and I really shouldn't say that on public radio, but hopefully they're not listening.
Standards and practices has changed a lot since you started writing for television. For instance, most of the standards and practices departments, from what I know, are smaller now than they used to be.
If they exist at all.
Mm-hmm. So how does that affect writing for TV now?
Well, there's a lot more latitude and a lot more permissiveness. Much more is based on the television's community's good taste, or supposed good taste. A new script that I'm doing, I haven't filmed yet, called The Boys, they objected to a line, which I believe was, there are probably as many guns as paper clips in this good old American society. And I couldn't believe, I mean, their reaction. I mean, who are they protecting, the NRA? Or, you know, that will remain in the script.
William Link, I want to ask you a question that I know you can't answer, and I'm not trying to hold you responsible for the content of this, but why is this TV season so bad? So many people I know, myself included, have been tuning in to watch some of the new shows and really have been somewhere between appalled and disappointed.
One word answer.
Mm-hmm.
Fear. You have now going on, half the audience is traveling over to cable and renting or buying video cassettes. And you would think that rather than panicking, the networks now would try out a lot more experimental drama and series concepts. And instead of doing this, they are retrenching, they're back down in their foxholes, and they're going for the formulaic material. I think the only answer is they are desperately afraid that the audience is defecting.
Well,
which it is.
If the ratings are bad for this season, do you think that maybe it would have the opposite effect, that they think, well, maybe we need to be more risky to keep people from...
No, I don't think that'll happen. I think they'll give you more and more retreads. It seems that no matter you know what executives are in there, it's a certain type of thinking. And it's a thinking that is repressive as far as interesting new ideas go. That has been the history of networks since their inception, and I don't think that leopard is going to change its spots.
You've been a producer as well as a writer for many years. When you become a producer, does that ever put you in the bad guy position, because you've got to make sure things don't go over budget, and you have to make sure that things can actually get on the air? You probably have to represent the company point of view at some times?
Well, that's not quite true.
Mm-hmm.
In that when Dick and I, and what I'm now doing, movies for TV, we own the negative. We are our own little production company. And we have always thought the producing was not negative, in that most writers are very reclusive. They write their scripts, they formulate their child, and then they hand it out the door to the network, the child molester. And then they're stunned that their child is molested. So we always thought that producing was buying an insurance policy on our script. The only reason that we assumed and put on the producer's hat was to protect our material. That was the basic reason. And yes, at times you have to be a bad guy. At times, you know, because it's your own money involved when you do a two-hour movie, we have to say, well, do we want to reshoot this scene? Do we want to go late tonight, which is money right out of our pockets? In most instances, we went for a better show for the quality and forsake the money.
Have you ever wished that you were working for, that you were writing or producing theatrical releases?
I'm about to produce a theatrical release. I just major motion picture. But usually I have stayed away from that side of the entertainment field because it's movies are basically a big star director's medium. Television is a producer-writer's medium. Directors flow on to other projects, and you actually recut what they did. You have much, much more power if you're what is known as a hyphenate in Hollywood. That is a writer-producer. Literally, you know, you get a major star in a theatrical motion picture, and you go get that person his or her cigarettes. You don't have the power. And that's why usually I've stayed away from motion pictures. And the picture I'm going to do, it's my original screenplay, and I will be the co-producer.
Mm-hmm. You, for most of your career, worked with your partner, the late Richard Levinson, and you knew each other dating back to junior high school days.
We met the first day of junior high school.
He died not too long ago, and I was wondering if it was difficult for you to work for a while, not only because of the emotional loss, but because you were just so used to working as a team.
Yes, it was a devastating loss. It was a shock. And for a year and a half, I produced. I was thrown into the chaos of the ABC Mystery Movie and the return of my old friend Columbo. But during that time, obviously my unconscious mind was working. And then after a year and a half on my own, because I don't think I'll ever collaborate again, Dick Levinson spoiled me. He was brilliant. At that point, obviously many things were storing up in that undermind. So I'm off again.
The screenplay you're writing now about two TV writers?
Yes, it's written. Hopefully we're going to film it in February. It will be an ABC movie of the week.
Is this based on your partnership with Levinson?
It has some autobiographical characteristics. The basic situation did not happen in real life to us, although it concerns one of the partners is a very heavy smoker, which Dick Levinson was, and his partner who did not smoke. And I do not smoke cigarettes. But the switch here, the situation is the non-smoker contracts terminal lung cancer because he's been in a room with his smoking partner for 20 years, 6 days a week. The drama is how they come to terms with this because they're not only partners in writing, they are best friends.
Was this ever a problem in your relationship, his smoking? Were you afraid of...
I tried to get him... No, I never had the fear. But I tried to get Dick off. I tried to get him on cigars. But he enjoyed smoking.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about your writing and producing for television. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
William Link is the supervising executive producer of the ABC Saturday Mystery Movie. He recently won the Ellery Queen Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Art of the Mystery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be dancer and choreographer Murray Lewis. He's been a pioneer of modern dance for 40 years, and now at the age of 60, he continues to dance. He recently merged his dance company with that of his mentor, Alvin Nicolai, and they'll begin an engagement in New York on October 17th. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jan Morris has traveled around the world as a man and as a woman. The popular travel writer underwent a sex change operation in 1972. Coming up, Morris reflects on her geographical and personal journeys. Also, Rock Critic Ken Tucker reviews Freedom. It's the new album by Neil Young, and Ken says it's the best thing Young's done in a decade. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Fabulous Baker Boys, starring Jeff and Beau Bridges, as a pair of nightclub performers who take on a singer played by Michelle Pfeiffer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The maker of an important AIDS drug has announced that it will donate millions of dollars of the drug free of charge to AIDS clinics serving poor and uninsured patients. More from NPR's Frank Browning.
Lifamed, which has come under bitter attack for alleged profiteering on the drug pentamidine, said its donation was intended to serve people who otherwise would be unable to get the drug. Pentamidine is used to prevent or treat pneumocystis pneumonia, the disease which most often kills AIDS patients. AIDS activists say that Lifamed has made obscene profits on pentamidine since it was granted exclusive rights to the drug by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The company has quadrupled the price per dose from $25 in 1984 to $100 today. And AIDS activists have begun helping patients fill their prescriptions in England, where the drug costs about $40 a dose. Lifamed says it has spent tens of millions on research costs to bring the drug to market and must get its money back. Health officials estimate that if all Americans who need pentamidine get it, they will spend between $2 and $4 billion a year on the drug. I'm Frank Browning.
Following last night's statement by the East German leadership that it's now willing to discuss the country's problems, West German newspapers have reported that East German leader Honecker is coming under increasing pressure from within his own ruling Politburo. Ben Bradshaw, the BBC, has more.
Reports emerging on the background to the Politburo statement paint a picture of an ever more isolated leadership. One in the reliable West Berlin newspaper Der Tagesspiegel even quotes a source in Moscow as saying, a clear majority within the East German Politburo wants Mr. Honecker to go. Whatever the truth of this report, there's no doubt the concern that Mr. Honecker is out of touch with reality is reaching the highest levels of the Communist Party. During the two-day emergency Politburo meeting, Mr. Honecker is said to have faced angry demands for an explanation of the current state of affairs. Many Central Committee members were summoned to the meeting, something that only happens when grave issues are to be discussed. They're reported to have warned the leadership of imminent strikes if change didn't come soon.
Ben Bradshaw, the BBC. In Poland, Lech Wałęsa said today, solidarity has saved the country from civil war, and if necessary, could do so again. The union leader warned, though, that Poland is facing painful times on its way to a more normal way of life because of rising price increases and food shortages. Northwest Airlines announced today it has ordered and placed options for 90 jets from the Boeing company. The airline said it's the largest aircraft order in its history, and it will come to $5.2 billion. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 13 points to close at 2,759 on volume of some 159 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Neil Young is one of rock's enduring stars, from his days with the Buffalo Springfield and Crosby, Stills and Nash through the ups and downs of his solo career. Young has a new album out called Freedom. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Freedom is Neil Young's best album since Rust Never Sleeps a decade ago, and it breaks the streak of more or less absolute junk he's maintained for most of the 80s. With the possible exception of Bob Dylan, Young is the most perverse of all major rock musicians, and he spent the past few years trying on different personas, impersonating bad country music, rockabilly, and blues singers. Who knows why? Young isn't offering any clues, but at least he's channeling his perversity into more interesting areas, such as this radical reworking of the rock oldie On Broadway. Neil Young takes the Drifters' Hymn to Hope in Big City, New York, and turns it into a lament of a naive fool who ends up a drug addict. By the end of the song, he's out of his skull, yelling for some crack to forget his pain. In the 70s, Young tended to devote whole albums to a single mood. Harvest in 1972 was a quiet, reflective, folky album, his most accessible and not coincidentally his biggest seller. Other albums like Rust Never Sleeps and Zuma in 1975 were loud, abrasive records in which the howling vocals were often indistinguishable from Young's guitar feedback. One of the things that's interesting about Freedom is that it combines these two styles. There are loud, thrashing numbers, but also a few quiet, lovely duets with Linda Ronstadt.
And when the melody through the window called, it echoed in the courtyard and whispered in the halls. He played it through the night. She knew he had to go. There was something about freedom he thought he did.
Sometimes Young combines the quiet with the loud within a single song, as he does on Don't Cry. He finishes the somber first verse, and then it explodes with a deafening guitar chord. It's as if Young had just walked away after setting a fire. Freedom is weakest when Young attempts some typically muddled sort of political statement. He said that much of the music on the album was inspired by the Chinese students' revolt in Tiananmen Square. That's what led to the name of the album, and on its cover he wears a soft cap with a star-shaped badge, the same sort of hat Mao Zedong used to wear. The album contains two versions of a song called Rockin' in the Free World. The first, which opens the album, is a loping acoustic version. On the second, which closes the album, he cranks up the volume and adds a verse taking a poke at George Bush. But of course, we should always remember that this is the same Maoist who in 1984 came out for Ronald Reagan and said, quote, "Americans need to stop being supported by the government and get out and work. You can't always support the weak."
Yeah.
Rockin' in the Free World is wildly, gloriously shameless. Its rousing chorus, Keep on Rockin' in the Free World, was designed to be played on all the lousy FM hard rock stations that never touched Young's best work. Rockin' in the Free World is Young's bid to create an anthem that will simultaneously unite and confuse, in the manner of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. In Springsteen's case, this was an unintended pop cultural happening. For Neil Young, it's a culmination of his cagey perversity, terrific music that makes you squirm.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Jan Morris is a celebrated English travel writer. In her 1974 memoir, Conundrum, she wrote, "I spent half my life traveling in foreign places. I have only lately come to see that incessant wandering as an outer expression of my inner journey." Until 1972, Jan Morris was James Morris. At the age of 46, Morris underwent a sex change operation. 2 years later, she wrote about her gender confusion in her memoir, Conundrum. Her new book is called Pleasures of a Tangled Life. In the prologue, she writes that there was a time when, new to womanhood, she tried to forget that she'd ever lived as a man, but it had grown on her over the years that this was not only intellectually dishonest, but rather dull. Yet Morris doesn't write much about gender in the new book. The book is about the pleasures that have sustained her over the years. She says a pleasure she can't recommend too highly is androgyny, so I asked her to explain.
Well, androgyny means to me that I have shared, if not in the present, at least in the past, a lot of the emotions and the experiences of both genders. And why I say the beginning of the book, chiefly to make you smile, that I highly recommend the advantages of androgyny. Why I said that was that in my experience, if you share both the emotions of both sexes, neither sex is frightened of you. Both sexes are willing to confide in you. Nobody thinks you're a threat. And since it seems to me that life, my life anyway, has been an urge, a constant urge towards reconciliation and unity, that does seem to be an enormous advantage in life's quest.
Can I ask you what some of the most surprising things you found were when you first started entering the part of the women's world that's closed to most men?
No, I think that's a subject that I explored and dealt with 30 years ago, 20 years ago anyway, and I don't want to go into that again.
Okay. When you were still writing as James Morris, you were best known for being the reporter who climbed Mount Everest with Edmund Hillary, and for your volumes, Pax Britannica, which was about the Victorian Empire. Do you think your writing changed when your gender changed?
To begin with, I did think so. I seemed to feel in myself more of a compulsion towards detail rather than sweep, if you understand me. It seemed to me I was exploring smaller things rather than larger things. But as the years have gone by, I seem perhaps simply to have widened, to be moved equally by both, if you understand me, both by macrocosm and by microcosm. And that may be, again, another symptom of the fact that I've come to terms with what I am more completely than I had some years ago.
You've spent about half of your life traveling, and I imagine that there are some countries that you've visited both as a man and as a woman. And I'm thinking specifically of cultures that have rigid gender roles. And I was wondering if you could compare for us what the experience was like or the way you were treated going to a country at different times as a different gender.
No, I think we're back to this, the whole business, which I really do not want to talk about anymore. I've had this for so long. And one of the purposes of writing this book was to lay that old ghost. and have done with it, which is why I dealt with the whole business of sex at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm. I guess why I'm asking you these questions is because you're one of the few people who have... I mean, you're a traveler, and you've written about your travel experiences, but one of the most interesting journeys you've made is a more personal one, and it's a journey very few other people have made, and surely very few other writers who are equipped to compare and to describe, and that's why I wanted to ask you more things about it.
Yes, of course, I quite understand. I'm not blaming you in the least. I'm just presenting honestly my own responses to it. And another thing I ought to say is that I think in a way I've wasted the experience. I think perhaps I ought to have done more interesting things with it than I have done.
Such as?
Well, I think it is a marvellous field for fiction. And as you say, I'm rather unusually qualified to write it. But so far, at least, I haven't been able to do that. I haven't artistically made enough of it, I don't think. But life is long.
Mm-hmm. You've traveled and written about travel for much of your life. And in your new book, you write that you regard travel not as a way to stand in somebody else's shoes, but rather as a big show. And I want to ask you to explain that.
Yeah, I think there are two ways of traveling and even more of writing about travel. I don't think of myself as a travel writer, and I don't believe in the genre of travel writing. I think I'm a person who writes about place. And there are at least two ways of doing that. One of them is, I think, more common among Americans, which is genuinely to try and get under the skin of the people in the place that you're describing, to put yourself in their shoes, to imagine what it's like to be them. I'm of the other school, an older school, really, which is simply to go and look at people. Sounds rather rude, but I hope I don't do it in a rude way. And as I say in the book, to regard the whole world as one terrific show, one great art gallery and pageant, especially put on for my own delectation.
So you think you write in a different style than many American travel writers do?
Yes, I do, and I think there are historical reasons for it, as a matter of fact. You know, I think that the Americans, having all, after all, come from somewhere else, perhaps feel, properly really, that they have an extra lean upon the world. They do genuinely, I think, have a more universal view than Europeans do, and therefore when they go abroad, it's easier for them, I think, to identify, and more natural for them too, to identify with other peoples. But for somebody like me, not merely from Britain, but actually from Wales, where my people have probably been since Neolithic times without much change, it's very much harder for us to pretend to identify with other peoples. And added to that is the old English culture, rather than arrogant insular culture, which led people back in the 18th and 19th centuries to go abroad in a spirit absolutely of slightly arrogant independence.
Yeah, well, you write that you had to learn to see Africa in non-colonial terms. What were some of the things you were up against because of your own upbringing that you felt you had to unlearn when traveling?
Certainly, I think the imperial aspect of it, because people of my age, I'm 63 this year, people of my age were brought up in Britain to think of the world as ours, really. The parts of it that weren't ours were generally misguided, and the majority of it was ours anyway and was coloured largely red upon the map. And so one went abroad in a spirit of unfair and illicit privilege. I remember Alan Moorhead writing about the British officers in Cairo during the war, and he said that all of them seemed to think that they came from very rich, privileged backgrounds. And of course they didn't at all. The richness and the privilege came from history and from the empire. And we were all, it was true of us all. And that is something that I did gradually unlearn. Like all the rest of us when I was very young, I went abroad in that spirit. Not exactly of jingoism, but certainly of overweening confidence.
Mm-hmm. One of the experiences that I think first made you famous, or kind of famous, was your experience on Mount Everest. You were there with Edmund Hillary when he scaled to the top. And you were the first person to report it to the press. What was the experience like when you got to the top there?
When you say sort of famous, you got it right.
Yeah.
it was Andy Warhol's fame, wasn't it? 15 minutes of it. But in fact, it changed my life, you know, because I was young and having a sort of specious success of that kind alters one's whole attitude and attitudes to oneself. I was only there simply to write about it, you know. And the excitement for me was not so much actually the getting to the top of the mountain as the excitement of getting a scoop, as we used in those days to call it, the only one I ever had.
And did you think, well, I'd better exploit this fame right away to get myself more pay for what I'm writing, or to write for a more prestigious place, or to write my first book or whatever?
No, I'm not a New Yorker. I was quite happy with what I was. The only thing I did want to do was to write a book about it. And unfortunately, the Times in those days was not only were all its correspondents anonymous, but you weren't allowed to do anything at all except write for the Times. So I, after a few years, I did leave the Times in order to write books.
You were really quite successful in the world of men. I mean, for instance, being able to climb part of Mount Everest, you were an officer in the cavalry. I guess wanting the gender change didn't have to do with what we would perceive as success as a man.
No, it didn't have to do with anything, as a matter of fact. It was a mystery to me then, and it remains a mystery to me now. I personally think it had some sort of a spiritual purpose behind it, which is inexplicable to me, but that's my own conviction.
I think it was at the end of Conundrum you wrote, "I have lived the life of a man, I live now the life of a woman. One day, perhaps, I shall transcend both." Are you still interested in transcending both? And what do you mean by that?
I think it's conceivable that I have transcended both, as a matter of fact. I feel myself to be part of each and of both, and that seems to me a not unhappy situation.
Did you say happy or unhappy?
Not unhappy.
Oh.
Somewhere in between the two.
What?
I rather like these double negatives.
Why would you prefer transcending both sexes rather than being part of one?
Because, as I said before, it seems to me the purpose of my life anyways is a quest for unity and a reconciliation. And that's a beginning, isn't it?
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Writer Jan Morris, her new book, Pleasures of a Tangled Life, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're putting together for us on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert Siegel.
Hello, Terry Gross. How are you? We're going to be hearing from Daniel Pinkwater today, the fourth of his recollections of life in Hoboken, New Jersey, some years ago. And also I'll be exploring with writers from the Oakland Tribune and the San Francisco Chronicle a question about the forthcoming World Series. You know, it involves the Giants and the A's.
I knew that.
and the question that I'm exploring is, what is, to people from the Bay Area, what is the moral contest at work here? I mean, I know what the Yankees and the Mets are like, but what are the real meanings behind the A's and the Giants? We'll find out.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fabulous Baker Boys is a new movie about what happens when a lounge act changes from a duo to a triangle. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Performing music, especially pop music, is a job like any other. And performing in a lounge act is the jobbiest job of them all. When you wind up gigging in hotels or in the kind of restaurant that serves poo-poo platters, wearing a tux and working your stage patter around songs like Close to You and Feelings, that means something has gone very wrong in your ascent to musical stardom. Either you weren't talented to begin with, like the pianist Beau Bridges plays in The Fabulous Baker Boys, or else you've buried or ruined your genius somehow, like Beau's younger brother, who's played by Beau's real younger brother, Jeff. The Fabulous Baker Boys is a wonderful, moody little movie that imagines the Bridges brothers as a terminally mediocre two-piano lounge act. Bo is the fussy, chipper one, the one who books the gigs and handles the finances. Jeff is the haunted, sullen one, who can't stop punishing himself for prostituting his gifts. Now their act is on the skids. It's time to hire a singer. And after 37 hilariously bad auditions, in she walks. For some reason, the boys don't seem to notice that she looks exactly like Michelle Pfeiffer.
Terrific. 38.
What's that, 38? What, you guys got some kind of code or something?
Name?
Susie Diamond.
Catchy. You have any previous experience as a singer, Miss Diamond?
No.
Any entertainment experience at all?
Well, for the last couple of years, I've been on call for the AAA escort service.
Pfeiffer does her own singing in this movie, and if she doesn't have much voice, well, as Tracy said of Hepburn in Pat and Mike, what's there is churse. Her singing does what cabaret singing must. It brings an actress's feelings and strategies to the song, and she hits the notes, too. When the boys add her to the act, their careers start to soar, and no wonder. Pfeiffer's sensuality in this movie is almost overwhelming, and it has a comic kick to it as well. She plays her character as what the movies of the 40s used to call a good time girl, only she's sexy in an 80s way. When Bo sees erotic sparks start to fly between her and Jeff, he becomes even primmer and more fuss-budgety, and the lounge act begins to strain at the seams. But during a gig at a ritzy resort hotel, Bo has to go away for a night, and Jeff and Michelle are left alone. That night, their stage act is wildly steamy, with Michelle slinking across the top of the piano in a tiny red dress, singing Making Whoopee, and giving an almost graphic demonstration of the song's not-so-hidden meaning. It's a brilliantly funny, yet oddly moody scene, and the movie is full of them. The 29-year-old writer-director, Steve Clovis, wrote the screenplay for Racing with the Moon in 1984, but this is his first screen credit since, and what he's accomplished is amazing. The Fabulous Baker Boys makes comedy out of the tackiness of lounge life, but it also gets at that life's haunting, romantic, melancholy side, the side that comes through in the best old lounge songs, the side Noel Coward was talking about when he remarked on the potency of cheap music. The movie isn't much on plot. Its true subject is the tension created when you crisscross those two central relationships, the cozy, contentious one between brothers and the charged, even more contentious one between people who are about to become lovers. The Bridges brothers have never been better. You can see the depths of their relationship in every gesture and between every line. The Fabulous Baker Boys works the way a great sad song works. It reminds you what's so good about feeling bad.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Ron Barron, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon is our director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Arthur Baker, one of the record producers that helped create the hip-hop sound of the 80s. Also, Harry Carey Jr. tells us about the westerns he made with John Wayne and John Ford. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.